Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have a story about a former Muslim who says he hopes more people who give up on the religion of Islam will talk about their experience. He says the more former Muslims know about each other, the more they will understand nothing is wrong with the decision to leave their religion. We will have more on that story later in the program. But first, the Ugandan government has set up a program to send almost 300 healthcare workers to work in Trinidad and Tobago. Critics say there is already a shortage of medical workers in Uganda. The move will leave many Ugandans without a healthcare provider. Jim Tedder has more on the story.
For years, Uganda has suffered from a lack of healthcare workers. Many skilled health workers leave the country in search of jobs, better pay, and healthcare centers with more resources. The government is now making such departures even more appealing. It plans to send 283 highly skilled Ugandan health workers to Trinidad and Tobago. 20 radiologists and one neurosurgeon are among the group, leaving Uganda with just 9 professionals in those fields. The team will also include 185 pregnancy and birth experts, called midwives. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs is hoping that workers in the program will send money back home for their families. These payments are called remittances. The government taxes them. Ugandan officials say they will use the tax money collected to improve the healthcare industry. Uganda has about one doctor for every 25,000 patients and one nurse for every 11,000 patients. The lack of medical workers leads to many preventable deaths. Pregnant women and those who have just given birth are among the high-risk medical populations. At least 17 women die each day due to problems during labor. Janet Obuni is president of the Uganda Nurses and Midwives Union. She says it is common for nurses in the country to go unpaid for up to 6 months at a time. She says this is one reason that work in foreign countries is appealing. Yet, she says, exporting workers will put many Ugandan patients in danger. A Ugandan Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesman says the government agencies involved have promised that the program will not endanger the lives of Ugandans. He says the government is supervising the process closely. I'm Jim Tedder.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA. Learning English. In 2012, Muhammad Syed helped launch an organization for former Muslims. It is called Ex-Muslims of North America, or EXIMNA. The group offers support to people who have given up on the religion and no longer feel required to follow its teachings. Kelly Jean Kelly has more.
No major organization has published information on how many former Muslims live in North America. But Muhammad Syed says EXIMNA has grown over the past 3 years. The group started with chapters in just 2 cities, Washington, D.C., and Toronto, Canada. Today, More than 10 Xmana chapters are spread across the United States and Canada. Membership is open to all former Muslims, but mainly to those who do not believe in God at all. Mr. Syed says, "The group is important because some former Muslims face difficulty when they say they will no longer practice Islam. We even had a few times when people threatened their own kids that they would be killed," says Mr. Syed. At one party, Xmana members exchanged gifts that celebrated their new identity. Gifts included things that Islam bars, alcoholic drinks, condoms, and a picture that said in Arabic, "There is no God." Sarah Hyder attended the party. She was born in Pakistan, but grew up in Texas. She says she never imagined someone could want to leave Islam. "I thought it was sort of a one-way street. You just found your way into Islam, and you stayed there," she says. Ms. Hyder adds that people who reject the religion are afraid to talk about it. "Many Muslims take it as a personal insult when you step out and step away from their religion," she says, "and I understand why that is, but I think it creates a situation where people are afraid to speak their minds, where dissent is not really respected on any level." Samira Mukhtar grew up in the United Arab Emirates, but later moved to the United States. She says she lost her belief in God after she heard a talk by an activist who believes religion and politics should be separate. Ms. Mukhtar says that attending events such as the Xmana party and being with other former Muslims makes her feel safe. However, Muhammad Syed warns that former Muslims can be victims of anti-Muslim prejudice, even in the United States. "My name is Muhammad," he says. "I've had people scream at me to go back home, even though I was born here." Mr. Syed points out the difference between criticizing Islam and having a problem with Muslim people. He says, "Unless this anti-Muslim bigotry is challenged and pushed away, there is no way for Muslims to actually start signing up and pushing back against the problems that exist within our cultures." Changing religion, or giving up on religion, is common in the United States. The Pew Research Center found that more than 1 in 4 Americans leaves a religious faith. The study also found that all major religions lose some U.S. members. Muhammad Majid is a religious leader at one of the largest mosques in the Washington, D.C. area. He says, "Muslims must accept how faith can change and follow the teaching of the Quran that says there is no compulsion in religion. In other words, religion is not required." Mr. Majid says the Quran talks about people who have changed their faith many times and were not put to death. He criticizes people who want to kill former Muslims. "I'm asking those people, what are you teaching?" he says. "Are you telling the person he has to pretend to be Muslim to be safe?" Mr. Majid adds that he will not let anyone harm former Muslims in America. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. It has been 1 year since Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 went missing. The airplane disappeared over the Indian Ocean on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The plane, a Boeing 777, was carrying 239 people. The past 12 months have been a difficult time for families with loved ones on the plane. They are no closer to knowing what happened. The only thing confirmed is an airline official statement from 1 year ago.
MH370 lost contact with Subang Air Traffic Control at 2:40 a.m. this morning.
Satellite records show Flight 370 likely crashed into the southern Indian Ocean. But months of air, sea, and underwater searches have failed to find any evidence of the plane. More than 20 countries joined in the investigation. At first, crews looked along the expected flight path and in the South China Sea. They later expanded their searches across parts of southern Asia. In all, crews searched more than 1 million square kilometers. The search of a smaller area is to be completed in May. Already, some people are asking, if the plane is not found, what then? Malaysia officially declared the plane's disappearance an accident earlier this year. That announcement cleared the way for Malaysia Airlines to make payments to relatives of the victims. But the move angered families in both Malaysia and China. American Philip Wood was on Flight 370. His partner, Sarah Bajak, spoke to reporters after Malaysian officials made the announcement. She said they provided no proof or physical evidence to support the declaration. In her words, there still is absolutely no verification for what they've done to come up with this decision. Just a few months ago, they were saying the flight was under the control of a hijacker. So how is it all of a sudden an accident? Sarah Bajak was not alone in her calls for more clarity. Most of the passengers of Flight 370 were Chinese nationals. In their search for answers, some family members organized protests. This has led to the government questioning their moves and watching their activities. Recently, some family members traveled to Malaysia to demand answers. Zhang Hu says one of their demands was to see images of their family members entering the airplane. He says the family members have always asked for a recording of the passengers as they prepared to leave for Beijing. As far as I know, he says, there are some Malaysian family members who have already seen it. They are family members just like us. Why can't we see our relatives? Aviation industry leaders are looking to improve safety worldwide. They hope to get better, more dependable equipment to monitor the movement of planes. The International Civil Aviation Organization has been considering several ideas. One proposal is to require aircraft to report their position once every 15 minutes, instead of the current once an hour. That requirement is expected to be in place by November of next year. In another measure, the United States plans to do away with flight recorders or black boxes that have battery power for 30 days. Newly manufactured devices will last 90 days. They are to be required in U.S. aircraft by 2020. And that's In the News. I'm Christopher Jones-Cruz.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Our story today is called Charles. It was written by Shirley Jackson. Here is Kay Gallant with the story.
The day my son Laurie started going to school, he began wearing blue jeans with a belt. I watched him leave with the older girl who lived next door. I clearly saw that this was the end of a period in my life. My sweet-voiced baby had suddenly changed. He was now a little man who was too full of himself to say goodbye to his mother. My son came home the same way. He shut the front door hard, threw his hat on the floor, and shouted, "Isn't anybody here?" At lunch, he spoke roughly to his father. "How was school today?" I asked. "Oh, all right," he said. His father asked if he had learned anything. Laurie looked at his father coldly. He said he had learned nothing. "The teacher punished a boy, though," Laurie said, with his mouth full of bread and butter. "What did he do?" I asked. "Who was it?" Laurie thought for a minute. "It was Charles," he said. "Charles was bad. The teacher hit him and made him stand in a corner. He was very bad." "What did he do?" I asked again. But Laurie slid off his chair, took a cookie, and left, while his father was still saying, "See here, young man." The next day, Laurie said at lunch, "Well, Charles was bad again today. Today, Charles hit the teacher." "Good heavens," I said. "I suppose he got punished again." "He sure did," Laurie said. "Why did Charles hit the teacher?" I asked. "Because she tried to make him use red paints. Charles wanted to use green paints, so he hit her. Then she hit him on the bottom and said nobody should play with him. But everybody did." The third day, Wednesday, Charles hit a little girl on the head with a piece of wood. The teacher made him remain inside all during playtime. Thursday, Charles had to stay in a corner during story time because he kept beating his feet on the floor. Friday, Charles was punished again because he threw a piece of chalk from the blackboard. I said to my husband that perhaps school was not so good for Laurie after all. He could be a rough boy. And this Charles sounded like such a bad influence. "It will be all right," my husband said. "There are sure to be people like Charles in the world. Laurie might as well meet them now as later." The second week, Laurie came home full of news. "Charles!" he shouted as he came up the hill. I was waiting on the front steps. "Charles!" Laurie shouted all the way up the hill. "Charles was bad again!" "Come right in," I said as soon as he came close enough. "Lunch is waiting." "Hello, Pop, you old mop," he said to his father as he came through the door. "You know what Charles did? Charles shouted so loudly in school that they sent a boy from another class to tell the teacher to make Charles keep quiet. And so Charles had to stay after school. All the children stayed to watch him." "What did he do then?" I asked. "He just sat there," Laurie said, climbing into his chair at the table. "What does Charles look like?" my husband asked Laurie. "What is his other name?" "He's bigger than me," Laurie said, "and he does not have any rubber shoes to wear when it rains, and he does not wear a jacket." Monday night was the first parent-teachers meeting. I wanted to go. I wanted very much to meet Charles' mother. But I had to stay home because the baby was sick. On Tuesday, Laurie said suddenly, "Our teacher had a friend come to see her in school today." "Charles' mother?" my husband and I asked at the same time. "Nah," he said. "It was a man who made us do exercises. We had to touch our toes like this." Laurie showed us how. Charles did not do the exercises. "Didn't Charles want to do the exercises?" I said. "Nah," Laurie said. "Charles was so bad to the teacher's friend that he would not let Charles do the exercises." "Bad again," I said. "He kicked the teacher's friend," Laurie said. "The teacher's friend told Charles to touch his toes like I just did, and Charles kicked him." "What are they going to do about Charles, do you suppose?" Laurie's father asked him. Laurie could not say. "Throw him out of school, I guess," he answered. Nothing special happened on Wednesday and Thursday. Charles shouted during story hour, and he hit a boy in the stomach and made him cry. On Friday, Charles stayed after school again. So did all the other children. With the third week of school, the word Charles had become part of our family. The baby was being a Charles when he filled his wagon full of mud and pulled it through the house. Even my husband, when he accidentally pushed an ashtray off the table, said, "Looks like Charles." During the third and fourth weeks, it looked as if Charles had reformed. Laurie reported unhappily that Charles was so good today that the teacher gave him an apple. "What?" I said, and my husband added carefully, "You mean Charles?" "Charles," Laurie said. "He passed out the paints to the other children. Then he collected the books. The teacher said he was her helper." "What happened?" I said. I could not believe it. "He was her helper. That's all," Laurie said. "Can this be true about Charles?" I asked my husband that night. "Can something like this happen?" "Wait and see," my husband said. "When you have a Charles to deal with, this may mean he's only plotting." He seemed to be wrong. For over a week, Charles was the teacher's helper. Each day he passed things out and he picked things up. No one had to stay after school. The parent-teacher's meeting is being held again next week, I told my husband one evening. I am going to find Charles' mother there. Ask her what happened to Charles. I would like to know. I would like to know myself. On Friday of that week, things were back to normal. "You know what Charles did today?" Laurie said in a voice full of excitement and wonder. "He told a little girl to say a bad word. And she said it, and the teacher washed out her mouth with soap." Charles laughed. "What word?" his father asked, unwisely. Laurie said, "I'll have to whisper it to you. It's very bad." He got down off his chair and went around to his father. His father bent his head down, and Laurie whispered joyfully, His father's eyes widened. Did Charles tell the little girl to say that? She said it two times, Laurie said. Charles told her to say it two times. Monday morning, Charles said the bad word three or four times. He got his mouth washed out with soap each time. That evening, my husband came to the door with me as I started out for the parent-teachers meeting. "Invite Charles' mother over for a cup of tea after the meeting," he said. "I want to get a look at her." "If only she is there," I said with a prayer. "She'll be there," my husband said. "I do not see how they could hold a parent-teachers meeting without her." At the meeting, I sat looking at all the women's faces. I tried to discover which one hid the secret of Charles. None of them seemed tired enough to be Charles' mother. No one stood up and made excuses for the way her son had been acting. No one talked about Charles. After the meeting, I found Laurie's teacher. "I have wanted to meet you," I said. "I am Laurie's mother." "Oh, we are so interested in Laurie," she said. "We had a little trouble with him the first week or so, but now he's a fine little helper. Most of the time, anyway. Laurie usually learns to obey and to cooperate very quickly," I said. "I suppose this time it was Charles' influence." "Charles?" the teacher asked. "Yes," I said, laughing. "You must have your hands full in that class with Charles." "Charles," she said, "we do not have any Charles in the class."
You have just heard the American story, Charles. It was written by Shirley Jackson. Your narrator was Kay Gallant. The Voice of America invites you to listen again next week at this time for another American story told in special English. This is Susan Clark.